And we are live.
Steven is the first one again.
All right.
And bookish.
Gracie.
We're going to give people a minute to come in, and we are going to get going with a very exciting guest professor today. Yep, there he is. Some of you might know him, some of you may not, but you're all going to be lucky today to be here with him. So you know how it is. Before we can do anything on this show, we need to do something first. Okay. Here we go. Are you guys ready? Let's do it.
It's going to be another amazing day today. I don't know if you're ready for it. Are you ready for all the amazingness?
I'm all crooked.
It's going to be coming at you.
Oh, my God.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome. Hey, shout out to me. Every now and then, my second feed comes alive. I don't know why. Well, welcome to Coffee with Scott Adams, the best time you've ever had in your life. If you'd like to take it up to a new level, a level that nobody can even understand with their tiny, shiny human brains. All you need for that is a cup of mug or a glass of tanker, chalice or stein, a canteen jug or a flask of vessel of any kind. Total your favorite liquid. I like coffee. And join me now for the unparalleled pleasure. The dopamine of the day thing makes everything better. It's both 70%. Happens now. Go. Meanwhile, all of the lazy podcasters taking the morning off. My goodness. My goodness. Do you feel sorry for them?
So that was our Scott. That was on 10/20/24. Yes, I feel sorry for anyone who's not joining us today, especially. I just want to quickly remind everyone that this is the Scott Adams School. This is streaming from Scott's platforms and channels, thanks to Shelley, who's letting this go on with us as Scott Wish. My name is Erica. I am joined today by Owen Gregorian and Marcella.
And our good morning, you guys.
Good morning. And our very special guest, I am so happy and honored that you're here with us. Before I fully introduce you guys, Stefan is amazing. Okay, this is what I want to say about Stefan Molyneux. He's a philosopher, probably one of the best and most downloaded. I think a million downloads is what I'm seeing. Stefan has a website called freedomain.com. We'll put it in the chat, freedomain.com. And I want you to know that I've been aware, and many of us have been aware of Stefan for many, many years. And he was also in Mike Cernovich's documentary called Hoaxed, which we talked about the other day. He's had the pleasure of interviewing and being interviewed by Jordan Peterson, Jordan's funny cousin, Jesse Lee Peterson, Noam Chomsky, Dave Rubin, Dinesh D'Souza, Peter Schiff, David Friedman, Candace Owens, James O'Keefe, Steven Crowder, Joe Rogan 3 times, and one of our favorites, Mike Cernovich. Okay, so if you haven't met him, you're going to meet him now. And what I want to say to anyone who was worried about having Stefan on because he was canceled once for thinking freely and speaking freely, is that's exactly why we love you, because our speech is free, our thoughts are our own, and if they make you uncomfortable, open your mind a little more and enter the world of philosophy. And our special guest, Stefan Molyneux, thank you for being here with us.
Thank you for the invitation. It's great to be here.
We sent out the link of your beautiful words and tribute to our beloved Scott Adams, and he obviously meant a lot to you. And I think it would be appropriate if we could just open thinking about Scott and maybe telling us how you first became aware of Scott and Scott with you and what his words and wisdom meant to you.
Yes, I would be happy to. And it's funny because I got a little blurry-eyed just seeing him again. And so, yes, I'd be very happy to unpack my heart in tribute of Scott. I actually became aware of him when I was in graduate school. Of course, Dilbert was in the papers, and I was an avid reader of, I don't know, I guess we can call them newspapers. For those who are under 40, you'll have to ask your parents what they were. But they were great for lining bird cages the next day and getting the propaganda delivered on ink straight to your eyeballs. So I'd read Dilbert and find him very amusing, of course. And then after graduate school, I got into the business world and very quickly became a pointy-haired manager. I actually became a chief technical officer at a software company that I co-founded. And I remember some of my employees would occasionally read Dilbert in this Samizdat subversive way, like they were reading Solzhenitsyn under Stalin or something like that. And I pointed out that I actually had a Dilbert calendar in my office. I had Dilbert pictures on the wall, and that actually got me a great degree of credibility as a manager. Like, I was on their side, I was one of them, and of course I rose up through the programming ranks. And I actually at one point was going to grow my hair out a little and tuft it up because that was still dark back then. And I found that Scott's takedown of corporate fluff and language was a beautiful and philosophical thing. I always found him to be deeply philosophical, like a lot of absurdist thinkers. And Scott very much pointed out the absurdity of office life, the pomposity, the verbiage, the catchphrases, the fear of HR, Catbert being the sort of the id, the conscience that could speak its mind because he was safe being a cat. In other words, as long as you're a pet that's not domesticated, you can speak your mind. And, all of the various characters really burned themselves into my brain. I remember being on a flight and Scott as well, because he was a hilarious cartoonist, like one of the best that ever was. And underappreciated, of course, as a comic writer, because most people know him from the comic strip, but his books were staggeringly good. As a bit of a writer myself, I just admired just about every sentence. And when you write yourself, like if you're a weightlifter and you see somebody lifting a great weight, you feel it, like you know, because you've tried to do that same thing. And seeing the leanness, economy, precision, and focus of his prose, and knowing as a writer that he probably sweated blood, you know, there's an old saying about writing, it's easy, you just stare at a blank piece of paper until beads of blood form on your forehead. Knowing how much Scott sweated over every sentence. Maybe it came easier to him, but I think he talked about how he worked very hard to make it precise and hilarious. I remember being on a business trip with my brother. This would have been 35 years ago. And we were reading about individuals, and it was hilarious. And we saw a reflection of all that we criticize in authority coming out from Scott in such a benevolent way. I mean, even the pointy-haired boss has his own charms. And Scott's obvious affection for the characters was really a beautiful thing, that we can love people and also love the absurdity that is within them. It means that we don't have this sort of Ayn Rand perfectionist mentality of who we have affection for. And I just found him to be a wonderful creative thinker and kind of a Loki-based chaos agent. And sort of let me explain what that means. And I hope I won't monologue too long, but I came from sort of a strict boarding school, Anglo-Saxon, precision, semi-military, got to bounce a quarter off your bed, everything has to be perfect, which, you know, from a software standpoint, from a business process and coding standpoint, you need that kind of strictness. And then into this sort of regimented life reveille and morning marches in my mind comes this absolute madcap chaos agent who smashes that in very, very healthy ways. It's like that old, everybody needs to bleed, that's how the light gets in. And I found that Scott's absolute irreverence without rage, because a lot of people who are irreverent, like, the Sex Pistols, they have this kind of rage to them. But his absolute irreverence and his absolute skepticism, absent rage and hostility, was a beautiful thing. And it got me a lot more, that bell curve. You need some order, you need some chaos in this life. And he dragged me from sort of that one valley all the way to the, I think, where I sit now, which is a, hopefully a decent combination of that Aristotelian mean, not too much order, because then you're, you know, like the 6,000 year Chinese society that never evolved, and not too much chaos. Otherwise, you can't plan and execute on anything. And I think he kind of helped drag me to that middle point of sort of ordered creativity, because I think he was an obviously ridiculously disciplined fellow. I mean, I would hear him talk about his day and I would just feel like, what have I done with my time? I mean, getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning and voluminous notes for every show and organize this. And then I have this project and I have this project and I'm opening this business. And I'm just like, wow. I mean, it's a nice life if you only have to sleep 4 hours a night. Good for you. That's not my particular circadian rhythm, but just his productivity. And then, you know, reading about the restaurants that he opened and things that he did, just a ridiculously skilled person in every venue and a genuine love for humanity, and one of the rare voices speaking, of course, about optimism for the future, which is so, so, so important. It's really impossible to fix the birth rate if people are just doom scrolling and waiting for the end of the world, either from an eschatological Christian sense or a sort of economic libertarian sense. And what a welcome a voice in the landscape. And of course, I as he got more and more sick, I found it hard to watch. Of course, I mean, everybody did. That sort of goes without saying, because it is very, very hard to watch, you know, the gods of fate snuff out such a bright candle in such a difficult way. And his courage in facing that, I did write to Scott and just say that one of the greatest things that he did was to help remove people's fear of death, because he had, you know, we all wonder how we're going to die. Particularly, I'm going to be 60 this year, so we all, you know, there's a lot more in the rear view than there is in the road ahead, and we all wonder how it's going to be. And everyone's like, oh, wouldn't it be nice if I died in my sleep, or, you know, maybe got hit by a bus unawares or something like that. But that's not how most of us are going to die. Most of us are going to die in a slow decline that we know long time ahead what's going to happen. And we all wonder how we're going to deal with it. And when we're emotionally invested and wrapped into someone's mind, which we are, you know, every time we meet on the internet, our neurons merge together. It's like two galaxies coming together with this great effect on each other. And the fact that he faced his death with courage, with resolution, with integrity, and continued to work and continued to do good all the way up to his end has given me, you know, as much comfort as you can have in the face of death, to realize that it can be an enriching experience. It can be something that gives you great focus, depth, and power. And while it is certainly something not to relish and embrace, of course, I'm sure Scott never woke up and said, I'm glad of the richness that my illness has given me, but out of great wrongs, out of great, I would say injustices because it's an accidental thing, but out of great suffering can come great gold. And that, given that there's going to be suffering in life no matter what, and life ends in suffering, the fact that he has taught us how to wring gold out of sort of the descending black capes of death's advance has given me, at least, and I think countless others, a great degree of courage and a lessening of the fear of the inevitable end. Having seen someone march heroically into the final battle we all face, you know, spraying flaming arrows of wisdom in every direction, has given me some real peace of mind looking down the road. So I can, sorry for the long speech. I hope that makes some sense, but that's sort of what I got out of it. And then just seeing him again, it does make me emotional,
yeah,
because
yeah,
he was totally a big part. And I was very honored to have talked to him a couple of times that I did.
Now, I noticed a lot of parallels in your life and Scott's in terms of some of the things you've been through. I mean, you also have been talented in many domains. You had a huge following on your free domain and still do, I think. But, you know, you went through a bunch of cancellation, probably one of the most severe other than maybe Alex Jones, yeah, where like every single platform demonetized you and deplatformed you at the same time. And probably for similar reasons to what Scott was doing, just kind of speaking an uncomfortable truth that, you know, inflamed a lot of people. How did you deal with that? And you know, what was that like for you going through that process?
Well, Scott's perspective helped me a lot. I mean, the power of the reframe is almost thermonuclear. I mean, there's a phrase in Hamlet that ever since I was in theater school, sort of rotated around in my brain, right? There's nothing good or bad, but thinking makes it so. And I'm not quite that far, you know, that you can be falling out of an airplane and think that you're on a wonderful ride at Disneyland. I don't think that you can go quite that far, and I don't think that Scott would think that either. But the power of the reframe is really, really important. There's another phrase, which is never underestimate what worst luck your bad luck has saved you from. So if you look at philosophers throughout history, and I would certainly put Scott in the category, at least, I mean, he was such a multifaceted person, but definitely philosophical. Being a God's Debris is a very philosophical work. So truth tellers are very much treading a tightrope, a line. This is all the way back to Socrates, of course, the holy trinity of the foundation of Western philosophy. Socrates, Aristotle, and Plato were all persecuted by the state. Early scientists, Galileo and so on, tortured. And Oscar Wilde said it very memorably, if you're going to tell people the truth, you have to figure out how to make them laugh, otherwise they'll kill you. Now, I was not blessed quite with Scott Adams' sense of humor, so I make a joke, and it's a fantastic way to bring pin drop silence to the room. It's a gift. It's a gift, really. And so I knew that there was this line that you have to walk in telling the truth. And I suppose it's something like therapy, where if you have some real selfish monster as a therapist, I'm sure you have to tell them that truth slowly over time, because if you tell them too much, they'll just rage quit and so on. So you kind of have to slowly knead the truth into people through their epidermis or something like that, because very few people can look at, you know, sort of bald truth straight up without losing their minds or being hyper-reactive. And people have been programmed that way, of course, to react to certain words and phrases in a hostile manner. So, you know, the rage of the mob is something that we all have to surf when you're trying to bring some truths to the shore. And one of the things that I thought about when I was canceled, which, as you say, was pretty brutal and extensive, but one of the things that I thought about was, how can this be beneficial to me and to the world? And also, how might it have been worse if I was not? In other words, if you are walking, you know, let's say you've got your headphones on and you're rocking out to some classic beats and you're about to walk in front of a bus and someone violently tackles you and throws you to the ground, oh no, I've been assaulted. And then the bus swings by and you're like, I've been saved. Lord above, thank you. I'm going to name 5 children after you and 3 of my pets and a goldfish. So what worse luck? And of course, this was brought home pretty vividly last September, of course, when Charlie Kirk, another person that I worked with to some degree, was gunned down. Because in my speaking tours, I've had to face the same death threats and bomb threats and had to have security and so on. And then there was another fellow who was beaten to death in France. And so what worse luck has my bad luck saved me from? So I chose to view the deplatforming in two ways. Number one, and this was an effort of will, because part of you is just like, oh no, my life, because, you know, my life's work off YouTube, which I had
I think you had almost 1 million followers at that point.
Well, they've never let me get to 1 million because they'd have to send me a plaque, which apparently they would have to produce by selling their children's kidneys, because they just did not want to give me that plaque, which I understand.
Of course.
But no, I had, I've had almost 1 billion views and downloads, and it was sort of, you know, 15 years of life work. No, I mean, I still have the videos and so on, so it's not like it's all erased, but it was definitely rough. And part of me was, you know, there is that tendency, that undertone, to feel like a victim, to feel like I've been so hard done by, and how dare they? And you look at all your options and so on. But then I thought, okay, so what are the positives that can come out of this? And, you know, thinking of Scott to some degree. So I chose to take two positives. One was liberation to pursue what I want, because when your audience goes down by, say, 95%, you can say, oh no, I've lost 95% of my audience, which, you know, happened for a while. Or you can say, I'm now not playing stadiums. I can play jazz clubs, so I can do my jazz. because I've always wanted to do jazz, man, because people were seeing me for like the Yesterday, All My Troubles Seem So Far. They were seeing me for the greatest hits, right? Which was fine. And I enjoyed that. Play the stadiums, play your three chords and, you know, rock on Cleveland. And I'm like, okay, so I've been delegated to jazz clubs so I can do the jazz. So I started writing fiction, which I hadn't done for a long time. I started reading audiobooks of my old novels, which I absolutely loved to do, to sort of bring those from the drawer and out into the world. I got to do more core philosophy, which I had done politics for a long time, which was, you know, very powerful. But again, that's where the lasers are on the forehead, right? So I got to do jazz. So that was a real benefit. I was liberated from stadiums, which I know sounds kind of funny, but if you've always wanted, like Sting, you know, when he was in the Police, he would do all of his stadium tours, and then he toured smaller places with his jazz bands for a while. And he seemed to like the jazz. So I liked the jazz. And that was number one, is it liberated me to do more of the core philosophy, like the nature of reality, metaphysics, the nature of knowledge, epistemology, and so on, which I've always really loved, and which is going to have the longest lasting effect, because I was thinking of people like Mark Twain. Now, Mark Twain had for decades a newspaper column. Nobody gives a rat's behind about his newspaper column anymore, but that's what people wanted in the time. But because he focused so much in the here and now, he had much less to offer the future, because all of those events have come and gone. So I was liberated from the sort of hamster wheel of the here and now, which has great effect in the present, but almost no effect in the future, to doing more core philosophy, which has, you know, less effect in the present, but much greater effect in the future. I mean, Plato, the philosopher, ran for office in Syracuse, and ended up being sold into slavery, because that's what happens when philosophers get into politics. He was going to be a slave for the rest of his life, except one of the people out there buying slaves happened to be one of his former students, who paid 400 drachma to liberate him and then returned him back to his life of philosophy. So politics is a bit of a filthy game, and, well, I'm just too snow white and pure, you see. But anyway, so I was liberated from that, got to do more core philosophy. That was number one. And number two was, I was knocked out of the way of an oncoming bus, because a lot of people have hit pretty ugly ends who've been involved in politics throughout history. Mm-hmm. And of course, we've seen it much more. So I think the deplatforming liberated me to do the jazz I love, which has a greater effect in the future. And also it got me out of the way of oncoming bullets and other social and political and legal repercussions, or whatever has been happening to people. So I really do. I know this sounds odd. I absolutely kiss the hem of the garment of the people who canceled me. It was a liberation and a reminder. Almost if the gods of the future were reaching back in time, they'd say, Steph, lots of people can do politics. Not so many people can do metaphysics and epistemology. Do your thing, man. Mm-hmm. Do the thing that's going to help us the most in the future, not the thing that changes people the most in the present. Because, of course, interfering with power 50 years after I'm dead, they're not going to bury me. They're not going to dig me up and do it again, right? But if you interfere with the, you know, come not between the dragon and his wrath, is that line from King Lear. If you come between political people and their goals, they have a lot more power to affect you than you have to affect them. But if you really work on core philosophy and morality, that really changes the future. Mm-hmm. So it was a big plus, and I'm enormously thankful for it.
Scott, same way, I believe. He felt liberated, and he felt he had the creativity shackles taken off of him. He didn't have to answer to the publishers of the papers anymore. And I think he had like a breath of fresh air once he realized, wait a minute. I mean, I think it was who came to his house that day? They went, oh, it was Joel Pollack, went to Scott's house the same day Scott got canceled and was hesitant. Should I go? Like, is he going to be upset? You know, what do I do? And he's like, no, we're going. We're his friend. We're going to show up. And Scott just said to him, like, I'm good. I'm okay. Like, this is all good. I will say your cancellation, Stefan, came when canceling became like the new thing. And it was like trying to behead somebody. You know, we're going to debank you, deplatform you, make you, you know, disappear from the world. And then I think by the time it got to Scott, he just realized like, oh, I'm just going to be even more free than I already was. And I'm just going to relish it and run with it. I love that. Marcella, I think you had a question too. Stefan, go ahead.
Oh, sorry. I just want to mention very briefly that maybe there was a bit of a trade. So maybe watching me be deplatformed and still have a great time gave Scott less fear of deplatforming, watching him die and be courageous with it. So obviously I get the much better end of the deal, but maybe there was that bit of a trade.
Reciprocity, so if you will.
Yeah.
It's an honor, Stefan, to talk to you. I'm an Ayn Rand objectivist, so that's where I come from. And you're a great philosopher. And I wanted to know who was your favorite philosopher and why.
Oh, Ayn Rand, yeah, without a doubt. Oh, yeah. Oh, I mean, she led me to Aristotle and the Greeks and all that.
Do you want me to be in love with you?
I'm rereading The Fountainhead for like the fourth time at the moment because I get something new from it every time I read it. So, oh, yeah, no, Ayn Rand, without a doubt, was the one. You know, it's funny that there's a the woman who taught Helen Keller, after she taught Helen Keller, who was, of course, blind, deaf and mute, and she taught her language, tracing things on her hands, a great movie about this. And people asked Helen Keller, like, what was it like before you had language? And she said, you know, just a chaos of sensations and blurs and static. And there was everything was scraps and colors and thoughts. And it was all. And for me, prior to philosophy, I mean, that was me. I mean, morally speaking, I couldn't fully accept the religious training that I got quite intensively growing up, because I could very much see that religion, Christianity, was not in the position to stop the evils that were accumulating in the world. And so I had to look for something else. And then a friend of mine was really into the band Rush. The drummer from the band Rush was really into Ayn Rand. And he's like, hey, man, you should read this book. And I just had this vague sense of like, some sort of science fiction, you know, a woman who wrote science fiction. So that was sort of unusual because he handed me Atlas Shrugged. But I thought, oh, that's a bit of a doorstop. Maybe I'll try ordering a slightly smaller meal first. And yeah, I read The Fountainhead, and it just hit me like an absolute ton of bricks. Then, of course, I plowed into Atlas Shrugged, We the Living, Night of January 16th, and Anthem, and all of her nonfiction work, and I was just like voracious, and the world came into focus. The my mind, which had been spinning in a void, hit the ground and had traction, because connecting the mind to reality is foundational for productivity. Your mind is there to change things in the world. It is not there to amuse itself. Mm-hmm. It is not there to preen itself or to show off to itself or to languish in its own inner sensations. Those are fine in emergencies, but you've got to actually get out there and do things in the world. But you have to know that what you're doing in the world is good, not exactly. Feels right, seems right, has approval. Heaven help you if you have approval these days, right? But the purpose is to actually do things in the world. But in order to have confidence and not be a psychopath, psychopaths have confidence, sociopaths have confidence because they're narcissists and nobody else exists for them, so there's nobody to oppose them. But if you have a conscience, you don't want it to tell you after the fact that you've done wrong. You need to know ahead of time with reasonable assurances that what you're going to do is going to be good in the world, and through objectivism and then, you know, to some degree, spiced up with Aristotelianism, because Ayn Rand, of course, was a huge fan of Aristotle. She named the three books in Atlas Shrugged after the three laws of logic. So it gave me attraction in the world. It gave me a clarifying way to organize my thoughts and to look for contradictions and inconsistencies. And it gave me reasonable assurances, it can never be 100%, but reasonable assurances that what I was saying, what I was doing in the world would actually be good, rather than blindfoldly throwing a ball and hoping you hit a target. Mm-hmm. Like, you may, but it's purely accidental and you can't reproduce it. So she gave me some reproducible skill in predicting the effect, the moral effects of my actions. And then, sadly, it took me an embarrassingly long time to actually bring the philosophy into every one of my personal relationships. And after that, it was good. Because, you know, there's the world, right? And there's the people you grew up with and the people you're friends with in high school and your family. And, you know, not many of them come along that journey of reason and virtue and integrity.
Yeah.
So well, I was like,
that's one of the things.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead, Marcel.
It's funny that you pick Ayn Rand, because she was mostly canceled her entire life, because she's still not considered like a sophisticated philosopher in philosophy in universities. you know, when I would bring her up in my philosophy classes, the professor would be like, oh, no. So it goes back to the theme of being canceled and being in this rogue kind of sense where you are like outside of society in a way. Mm. And that kind of brings in like Scott being canceled, you being canceled and feeling that. Mm. It's just interesting to me.
Well, of course, academia has as its pinnacle Michel Foucault.
Yes.
And now Michel Foucault was one of the most skin-crawlingly repulsive. Like, if Ayn Rand would write him as a villain, people would say, oh, come on. I mean, Ellsworth, too, he was bad enough. Michel Foucault, I mean, he was a completely void of any virtue, absolutely hedonistically narcissistic, a disease spreader, drug addict, BDSM fetishist, whose the accusations are, I won't even get into them here, but even the things that aren't accusations and are validated is that he was one of the most skin-crawlingly repulsive human beings to crawl the face of God's green earth, and he is the most cited thinker. And it's wild. Of course, all the French intellectuals who wanted to lower the age of consent to about 4 minutes after birth. I mean, just absolutely repulsive human beings. And these are the people who are, and you can't have both. You can't have both. You can't, just go north and south at the same time. No problem. And you can't have these absolutely repulsive, hideous human beings at the pinnacle of your moral and intellectual edifices, and then also bring in that smoky-voiced Russian goddess of reason known as Ayn Rand and have the two not duke it out to the death.
Oh, my gosh.
No, I also see a parallel with you and Scott just being sort of very rationally focused in terms of, you know, you think of yourselves as very rational people and maybe more rational than average. And Scott seemed to go in this other direction with hypnotism and persuasion and essentially coming to the conclusion that people are not rational 90% of the time. And that includes him and you and me and everybody. And so he seemed to move in this other direction of kind of trying to appeal more emotionally or, you know, with visual language and different things. And I guess my perception of you is that you went the other direction in terms of sticking to the rational side. I don't know if that's true or not, but I wanted to see what you had to say about that and like maybe how you approach persuasion.
Scott bugged the ever-living crap out of me about that. He really did. He really did. Because here I was with all of my lovely crystalline syllogistical theories that are all written out and validated and logic treed and all that kind of stuff. And Scott was out there communicating with people in a sort of very effective metaphorical and florid language and understanding persuasion. And he bugged the living crap out of me, as usual, because he was kind of right. I mean, it's all very well to have these big theories, but if you can't get them out there into the world, again, that's sort of the mind that's spinning but not hitting the tarmac and getting somewhere. So in watching Scott, of course, emotional persuasion, analogies, and also, you know, you kind of have to be a reasonable and happy person in order to sell, you know, the classical Socratic formula. Now, reason equals virtue equals happiness. I think that comes out of Ayn Rand as well. And so, yeah, he bugged me because I'm like, oh, who cares about hypnotism? I'm right. Who cares about convincing people? I don't have to do anything but be right. And it's like, you kind of do, though. You kind of do. It's because I was in marketing as well. So I originally built software products and then I ended up out in the world selling them. And it took me an embarrassingly large amount of time to say, great software products, no marketing. What happens to those? Exactly, right? So yes, he was very, very keen in his analysis. Sort of razor sharp in his analysis of persuasion. And I came, you know, he predicted Trump's win, as did I, but he came from it from a persuasion standpoint, and I came from it from another direction. And of course, without the persuasion, without the ability to engagingly and enjoyably communicate to people, it's like you can write the greatest song, but if you only play it in your own toilet, it ain't getting to number one.
What direction did you come from with Trump?
Oh, I mean, I just knew that the American population was desperate to have borders and to have less immigration, and that when you are in academia and you're in the media, you are in a tidal wave that feels like it's not moving because it's moving so rapidly. You're in it. Like, you know, you think of little plankton in a tidal wave. Do they even really know that there's a tidal wave until it hits, right? Or tsunami. And so because Scott and I didn't come out of academia, I mean, I did a graduate degree, but I didn't stay in academia, we could see from the outside the tsunami of the woke stuff, the left-wing stuff, the really centralized planning stuff, the and anti-white stuff and all of that. We could see all of that being outside. And the view from inside was like, you know, it's like the fish, you know, the old thing. Well, water, what water? You know, it's lukewarm, you can't feel it. And so we could see a momentum and a direction and a fear in the general population that we shared, I think, because we were outside the sort of bubble. But we were seeing the direction of momentum. So we could see that the Trump was standing before that, saying, you know, like Gandalf on the bridge, like, it shall not pass. And so we could see that. I think, I don't want to speak for Scott, but I could certainly see that mechanism and people in the media and people in politics and people in the arts, I mean, and in academia, they couldn't because they didn't understand what it was like from outside the tsunami, so to speak.
So I'm the one on here that everybody knows that's always like, please help me stay calm. I worry about the world as most people do. And, you know, Scott would always talk about, you know, don't worry about these things. You know, it's a slow moving disaster. And we're very good at seeing the disaster ahead of us and being able to pivot. Personally, with the things I'm seeing, like, especially after watching the amazing speech that Rubio gave and the disastrous responses from people like AOC, I feel like we aren't slowing the ship fast enough, especially when we have politicians who are in another country trashing the country they're supposed to represent. Same with some of the Olympians. And it's become like the thing to be doing. So help me and the people on here like me who worry. I'm like an Italian grandmother. So what do we do collectively? Like, what can you prescribe to us to help us stop this ship from hitting the iceberg? That looks like we're going to me, it looks like, you know, we lost borders for a long time. It's going to take a very long time to remove these people. You know, when bad people leave one country and come to another country, they're still bad people. Mm-hmm. So now we're being overrun with gangs from all over the place. And well, we know what's happening. So what do we do? Because I am very worried, Stefan. I'm very worried about our country and I'm worried about the world, because how many times do people say, like, I'll just leave, I'll just move. Really? Where are you going? Like, where are you going? So what do we do?
Right. Well, I mean, for over 20 years, I've been talking about parenting, and I know that parenting is a slow process, right? Obviously, I think most of us here, well, we would all understand that. So peacefulparenting.com is a free book on the philosophy of parenting, and that has produced, of course, now I've been talking about it for over 20 years. So some of the people I talked about very early on, their children are now adults. My daughter is going to be 18 this year, so to raise children in a peaceful, negotiated, and rational fashion makes them completely immune to political temptations. Because politics is about forcing people to do stuff. And if you raise children with reason, with evidence, and with negotiation, then they don't have the urge to force people to do stuff. And they are kind of immune to other people forcing them to try to do stuff as a whole. So there's a whole mindset thing that you can do about that. I do understand it's, you know, perhaps a little late in the game. You know, plant a tree because you're looking for some shade that afternoon is not necessarily the best approach. But I would certainly keep focusing on that. And even people who have teenage children can change their parenting approaches. So the philosophy of parenting is one of the things that I've really worked hard to add as value as a thinker, because philosophers have talked about everything under the sun, except, you know, the most moral mission that every human being is ever involved in, which is raising children. That's the most moral thing. And I think philosophers have been, well, a lot of them are, I wouldn't say incels, but a lot of them were not overly blessed with the ability to charm women and so on. And so they ended up, a lot of them single, a lot of them isolated. So they didn't really talk that much about parenting, which I think was a real shame, because that could have changed the world quite a bit. Mm-hmm. So you, well, for me, live with maximum integrity and make sure that your values are brought to life in your personal relationships, which means if people are, you know, super pro-political and want you thrown in prison for, like, we should have hate speech laws. Okay, well, then you want to throw people in prison for legal speech or for speech that is not incitement to violence or, you know, that kind of stuff. It's not direct threats. And so recognize that when people want to use the power of the state against you, they're kind of enemies. Now, you can take some time to alert them to this, to wake them up to this, because, you know, it's like you don't want to wake someone up by going, you want to wake someone up a little gently, you know, stroke their arm a little, wake them up. But at some point, they do have a responsibility to wake up. And people who are addicted to using the power of the state to get their way will tear apart the world, and you can end up in a gulag. So if they get their way, so you have to really have that line after a certain amount of communication and moral instruction. You have to have that line where you say, no, this is not real. This is not virtuous. This is not good. I call it the against me argument. Like, you support the use of violence against me. And you got to wake people up to that. Now, if they're like, oh my gosh, I'm against violence. I'm so sorry. You're right. But if they're like, well, yes, I do. And I'm happy about it. It's like, okay, hit the eject button and get out. I mean, the left is very good at this. And we need to learn from the left because they do this very well. They are intolerant of people who disagree with their views. I wouldn't say that. I am intolerant of people who want to use violence against me for peaceful speech and peaceful actions. So you got to bring these things to life in your actual relationships. And then the plus of that, and you know, what is the opposite of worry, is not comfort, it's love. Because if you have adversity and you have people you love and who love you, then the adversity, which is inevitable in life, diminishes enormously, right? I mean, whenever you have to move, you don't do it alone, right? You don't try and carry some giant couch down a spiral staircase with someone yelling pivot at you. You hire people because, you know, heavy loads is only lightened with good companions. And if you live, you know, with that kind of virtue, with that kind of integrity, with that kind of directness, and you shave off the bad people from around you, because, you know, bad, corrupt people act as a moat to keep the good people away. You end up sealed in this chamber of malintent. And so if you have love, which is only possible through virtue, love is our response to virtue and nothing else. If you have that and you have love, you know, then you can bear almost anything with grace, and the inevitable negatives that occur in life, either politically or personally or health-wise or whatever. You have someone in your corner who genuinely loves you. You genuinely love them. You have people in your life where you have this, you know, shared strength of, you know, co-mingled affections. That's about as good as you can get. You know, yes, you can still talk to people about politics, and for sure, I still do that from time to time. But if you aim at virtue, then you have the capacity to love and be loved in a very deep and meaningful way and permanent way. I say this as a man who's been married for 20... Oh, I should know this. No, I'm a man. I don't need to know this. 23 years or something like that. So if you have that, then you reduce your worry, and also your values have a purpose and reward. Because one of the things that Scott was talking about was, you know, it's difficult to be honest. It's difficult, but there's rewards on the other side of it. There's a good conscience and better relationships and so on. And so we as individuals, we can't just go out there and change the world in the way that we want, which is good, because if we could do that, evil people could do it, and they have often a higher incentive. So it's good that we can't do that. But we can influence people as much as humanly possible in the most positive direction. That's the best chance we have of saving the world. You know, like if you don't want to get lung cancer, don't smoke. You know, does that mean you won't get lung cancer? Well, no, but it means that you have a much lower chance. And the more that we enforce and spread virtue in our personal lives, the more we challenge people's anti-rationality and bigotry, the better. And that's really all we can do. And I will say this, sorry, just to close off, because I was kind of out in the wilderness for like a half decade, when I came back, my ex account got reinstated. When I came back to social media, holy crapola, it was a completely different planet. Stuff that was absolutely appalling, shocking, you know, people's heads would explode. It's like, it's common discourse now. I mean, it's wild. It's wild. See, all I had to do was leave and everything got better. That's the causality. I just had to step out of the room and everybody knows how to cha-cha-cha. And so if you see this change slowly, you don't notice it as much. You know, like if your friend has lost 50 pounds, they lost it over time and it's a little bit. But then if you haven't seen them for a while and you see them, it's like, oh my God, this is crazy different. And the discourse that is going on now, I mean, people are routinely chatting about topics that I would have been like shaky hand typing, you know, 6 years ago. And like you said, the Rubio speech is like anti-white racism, like IQ, voluntary family relations, even with parents, like all of this stuff is talked about like it ain't no thing. And it's like, it kind of was a thing.
Yes, it was.
You know, this is like Galileo coming forward 400 years and like, oh, everyone. I should do a bad Italian. Oh, everybody does say that everybody does say that the earth goes around the sun. And everybody knows that. And it's like, yeah, everybody accepts that. It's like, I got the tortured for, you know, like, and so this is wild what has changed. Yeah. And that level of progress has never before been achieved in human history, where the Overton window is like a bullet train these days. And that's incredible because, you know, this is an old Marxist saying, like, there are decades when nothing happens, and then there are weeks when decades happen. And that these last couple of years have just been, you know, face meltingly, like you feel like one of these astronauts going through gravity training by being whipped around, like your skin is peeling back from your eyeballs. And it's like, oh, how can things have changed so much? All I had to do was leave and everyone becomes perfect at truth. It's incredible.
How do you look at the fertility crisis? Because that's still a huge problem in the U.S. I haven't seen much of a turnaround here, and it's even worse in many other countries around the world. What do you think needs to still change to get people to want to have more kids?
Well, there's very complicated, sophisticated answers. But what I would say, and we get timing. What's the time? Oh, no, I've lost track. Oh, we got a little bit of time.
No, I was saying, so the phones have to go away for families to grow, I think, all the doom scrolling.
Yeah. So whatever the problem is in society, the solution is always less violence, less initiation of the use of force. So, of course, the domestic population is being taxed to subsidize the non-domestic population to have a lot of kids. This is happening all across the West. It really is one of the most sinister things that I've ever seen, because I'm old enough to remember when all of the Western women were said, you can't have children, the planet, you can't have children. You know, it's ZPG, zero population growth. It's so bad for the environment. It's, you know, it's going to kill the planet. You can't have children. And now it's like, oh, sorry, there aren't enough children. We need to import everyone on the planet. And it's like, that is a brutal, sinister pivot that's not really being talked about as much as it should be, because, and also it's so painful for women to think that they got talked out of having children, because it's kind of a satanic lure. You know, dating and finding yourself and travel is way more fun than getting up for the third time to feed a baby. You know, just do that, you know? So I think that sort of devilish temptation of, you know, a lot of education, because education is pretty easy. I mean, I was in university. I was kind of shocked at like, what, 10 hours of classes a week? Are you kidding me? What am I supposed to do? I can only get so good at hacky sack, man. So whatever the solution is, it's less violence. We need less coercive transfer of wealth from the productive to the unproductive. Because in the past, smarter people had more kids, because smarter people generally made more money. They could afford to have more kids. Smarter people generally had more kids, which, you know, did a good thing to raise the IQ of the world as a whole. Now quite the reverse is happening. Women in particular with more education, women in particular, and I would say education in very, very loose quotes, right? Less subsidies for higher education. Women and men both need to be treated equal in the workplace. No quotas for women, nothing like that. And then things will begin to change. You need fewer people pouring into the country, because then it's going to bring down the price of housing. Because that's how it's supposed to go. You got a baby boom, you build all this infrastructure. Then there's fewer babies in the future, which means the price of everything's supposed to come down, which encourages people to have more children. But that's all being buoyed up by a variety of government programs and policies, of which immigration is a key one, to buoy up the value of the boomer's house, to give them the illusion that they haven't been robbed blind by Social Security and the decoupling of fiat currency from any hard assets. So it's all, you know, if you want to know the real price of American currency, just look at it relative to Bitcoin. It's dropped like 99.99% in 15 years. 40% of all the currency ever created in America was created over the last couple of years. I mean, there's nothing there but this endless roll of toilet paper with a president's face on it. But you've got to give people the illusion of value, so you've got to artificially stimulate demand for housing, in particular with immigration and things like that, and restricting the building of new housing. So housing prices have to come down. Wages need to increase. They've stagnated since the 1970s. Since 71, when Nixon took America off the gold standard, wages have stagnated, and the American economy, unfortunately, and this is true of most Western economies, it's largely illusion propped up by propaganda, debt, and force, because you have to use fiat currency to pay your tax bills. So, yeah, the solution to that is less force, less compulsion, less forced income transfers, less forced hiring, less forced student loans. And it would be great, of course, if you could discharge your student loans in bankruptcy. That would be just delightful. And if the universities would be off the hook, and then they wouldn't dangle all of this nonsense in front of people to financially enslave them for the rest of their lives in return for having them pay for their own Marxist indoctrination that has them be completely terrible employees. Okay, there's my answer.
So would you agree that so I'm on the kick, kind of like the Mike Rowe kick of forget college, you know, learn a trade, build your family, you know, unless you're going to school for something specific, like you want to be a doctor or whatever. But, you know, why come out in debt with a job you're not going to find in whatever it is that you studied? I think to keep this country going, we need tradespeople now. Everybody wants to be a TikToker. Nobody knows how to lay a brick or do electric anymore. I mean, everyone that works on our house and our friends' houses are, you know, my age and older. And I'm like, oh my God, we got to get everything done before we all die because nobody will be left to fix our air conditioning, you know? Right. So I just feel like, and I also feel like maybe if people do focus on a trade, you're younger, maybe you come out of college, I mean, you come out of high school and you take an apprenticeship with a tradesperson and you learn a skill and a trade that you can take with you for the rest of your life and you start building your family faster instead of waiting of going through college and coming out in debt and definitely not being able to buy a home is one solution I feel like could happen with the younger generation.
I think that's certainly true, and I'm so committed to being a TikToker that I will learn those cat's eye Korean TikTok dances. I will. Oh, it won't be pretty. Maybe I can charge people to turn it off. But
I actually would pay to see that.
Doing cat's eye dances. I could probably do them once. Just once.
Once, yeah.
And then be carried off in a stretcher.
Sergio could probably make some AI version for you.
Yeah.
No, that's cheating. So the trades, yeah, I think that's fine. But I think people should very much look into entrepreneurship. You know, generally, our history was entrepreneurship. You say, oh, I'm a smith in some village. It's like, yeah, but you still had to go out and sell your services. And so we kind of were petty bourgeois or entrepreneurship. So sit down with friends. Everyone's getting together and it's like, oh, let's play Fortnite. Okay, fine, play some Fortnite. But also sit together and say, hey, if somebody had a gun to our head and we had to make, $10,000 in 2 months, what would we do? And just put that forward as an absolute, you know, they got elephants over the mountains. Our ancestors survived, you know, entire winters on three sardines. You know, you can do unbelievable things if you make the priority high enough. And of course, a lot of modern society is about distracting you from self-fulfilling and productive priorities. So yeah, sit down with your friends and say, okay, let's say that your dog was kidnapped and we had to come up with $10,000 ransom in a month. What would we do? And just brainstorm about things and get your skills together, get that jigsaw puzzle together to start being able to make money. Because once you become an entrepreneur, I mean, I had my corporate jobs, but I've been doing entrepreneurship for, I don't know, like 25 years or more. And really, there's no substitute. And so people should be getting together, particularly young people should be getting together with their friends and say, what could we do? Come on, let's just whiteboard it. Let's blue sky it. No idea is wrong. No idea is too bad, except OnlyFans. So you people should be really sitting there saying, rather than going on this kind of silly train track of other people's expectations and on the conveyor belt that society leads you towards, which just goes off a fiscal cliff, you know, jump the tracks and figure out what you can do on your own. I mean, when I was a teenager, I was putting up little signs in bus stops saying, I'll do your typing for you, because I was a pretty good typist from writing all of that. Just do that. Anything to just figure out how you can make some money. The opportunities that are available now online to do stuff to make money is staggering.
Yeah.
Never, ever put a ceiling on your ambitions. It's a kind of vanity to say I can only go so far, because you don't know what is lurking in your unconscious that could be incredibly productive. The unconscious mind has been clocked at 8,000 times faster than the conscious mind. Unleash all of that by removing any ceiling on your abilities and just figure out what you can do, because if you're willing to think hard and take risks, you're already ahead of 99% of the people, and it's very hard to fail.
Yeah. And I a lot of people are worried about AI taking away all the jobs, but I look at it also as a huge enabler for entrepreneurship, because to whatever extent it is going to take away people's jobs, it also means as an entrepreneur, you can do a lot more and maybe have a profitable business that wouldn't have been profitable 10 years ago.
And there'll always be people, boomers, who don't really get AI. And my mother was still referring to her CD player as a gramophone for many years. So there will be boomers who are like, don't really get AI, don't understand it. And you can just use it to sell stuff to them.
I love that gramophone. Go ahead, Marcella.
I wanted to ask you about your projects coming up in next month. I think you're having a debate at Word War Debate.
Yeah, it's going to be on April the 11th in Atlantic City. I'm taking a risk. But yeah, ooh. So I'm going to go out. I think we're going to be debating the nature of truth and knowledge, which is juicy, juicy, meaty stuff and really, really essential to get that rubber on the road of the mind. So we'll be doing that. I recently was in studio with Sam Hyde, and we did a really... I've never been on quite a ride like that. And that man makes Scott look like early me in terms of chaos agent. So, but we did some really, really great conversations and great debates. So I think that's coming out shortly. And so, yeah, I've been a studio band for a while, but I'm sort of back out on the road a little bit because I really do love working with an audience. I love chatting with people. And so we're going to try and do sort of a dinner with people and all of that. So yeah, it's been a while.
I might have to come to Atlantic City to see you.
Oh, I would love to, shake hands and swap minds. So I think that would be great. So yes, that's going to be going on in Atlantic City. WordWarDebate.com is the place to go. I don't think the tickets are quite available yet, but I think they're coming out soon.
We'll drop all of that for you after the show in the chat. And I also want to remind people that you can get Peaceful Parenting. It's a book that's free, right, Stefan?
The book is free. And there's also an AI there that's been trained on all my parenting material. If you have specific questions, you can check out the AI. Yeah, just peacefulparenting.com.
Who doesn't want all the help they can get? Peacefulparenting.com. And Stefan's website is freedomain.com. We're going to put everything in there. And that's also his Twitter handle is freedomain. Or you could put Stefan Molyneux. We'll put everything in there for you guys. And you can go back to his website and look at all the interviews and talks. And it's a great website, Stefan. It's very informative. So
you have a locals community too, right?
At freedomain.locals.com.
So we're on Locals also. This is where I try to like wrangle you in to commit to all sorts of things. Mm-hmm. One, would you come back with us again?
Absolutely. I mean, if you guys find it of value for me to chatterbox my way through your hour, I'm very happy to come back.
We crave your kind of thinking. And it's so amazing. You might hear my cat with dementia meowing in the background.
I thought that was my conscience. I'm very glad that my conscience is not meowing at me because that would be tricky.
It's just Stella. and also, maybe we could do something on Locals, like a longer form Q&A where we can actually take questions at Scott's Locals. And that would be amazing because there's so many questions happening for you and just not enough time, obviously, today. So I just want to see, like, Owen, do you want to wrap up with another question? Or Marcella, we want to use every minute we have. We have 3 minutes.
Marcella, do you have anything else?
Oh, I have all sorts of stuff. I'm so glad you're here. I adore you. And I wanted to know what your thoughts are on AI. I think that's another realm that I'm not sure what your thoughts are on that.
Yeah, so AI will replace people who don't think. So we've got to get people to start thinking. Because AI is just a word guesser. I've done whole presentations and interviews on AI. And as a coder myself for many years, I think I understand the basic principles. So AI turns a computer into an unthinking human being who just repeats slogans and navigates the way through the most common and approved sentence formats. So if you're an NPC, then you can be replaced by AI. So you need to start thinking from first principles creatively and originally, then you can't be replaced if you are just repeating the general propaganda. And I don't mean to criticize or bug anyone about that. That's kind of how we all start. I did it. And we all start that way. But we're going to kind of bust out of that egg of solipsistic propaganda and get out there and really think in the world. But the best way to protect yourself against the ravages of AI is to start to think from first principles. I've got a whole book called Essential Philosophy, essentialphilosophy.com. It's another free book that's, I've got Art of the Argument, artoftheargument.com. It's sort of teach people how to think from first principles. And so, yeah, if you're scared of AI, AI is a wonderful opportunity to stimulate you into breaking out of propaganda, because that's all AI is just repeating what everyone has said before. As Ayn Rand would say, social metaphysician, a second-hander, right? Don't be just a reflection of other people's thoughts. And so AI is like the camera. You don't see people painting portraits that much anymore because just take a picture, right? So AI just reproduces what is. You have to be a more imaginative artist. You have to be able to think for yourself and create for yourself. And then the more that you think and create, the more you can wind into AI itself. I mean, AI has hoovered up all of my books, and therefore I've had some adjustment to AI itself. But there is no defense save clarity and originality, because everything that is repetitive is going to be automated.
Luckily, we have people like Scott. We have hundreds of hours. We have Stefan, who's got a treasure trove of information. He will be back. Everybody loves you. They've enjoyed this so much. So have we. I can't thank you enough. I hope you found this enjoyable. And you guys, we will post the show. I'll post it on my X feed. And you guys, in the comments below, I'll make sure I tag Stefan in there. Tell him how much you loved him today, what your favorite things were, and be sure to follow him and subscribe to everything. And we'll be back on again. Everybody said yes, please make him a repeat guest. So we would love that.
And just final statement, just big hugs to everyone. I said this before the show, but you know, we're all dealing with this loss. You guys much more, of course, than I am, being so close to him. And just big virtual hugs to everyone for dealing with this loss. We should all live a life as meaningful as to be mourned by millions. And that is the greatest testament to everything that Scott did. And thank you guys so much for keeping this conversation running, because for the conversation to die with Scott would be the final nail in the coffin that we don't need.
Amen to that. Let's have a closing sip, you guys. Thank you, Shelley, for letting us continue this. And please, a closing sip to Scott. As he always said, be useful. And we love you guys. And we'll see you tomorrow. To Scott.
To bye-bye. Scott.
Bye, guys.